This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome back, everyone, to Seaweed Brain, a Percy Jackson podcast, where we are still in our post-season one era of the Percy Jackson TV show, deep diving into special elements of the show, doing interviews with the cast and crew. Today, we have a special deep dive conversation episode on all of the music of season one, and we have the perfect special guest here to join us. Stick around.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back, everyone. My name is Erica, joined as always by my co-host Carter.
Hi, it's me.
And today we are joined by a returning special guest, Jay Maya. What is up? Welcome back.
Hi, everyone. I am so honored to be back for a scintillating conversation about my favorite things, music and Percy Jackson.
This is literally, like, we joked about doing this, but I'm so happy that we were able to make this happen, like, sort of last minute, because this really is, like, my dream people to be having this conversation with. I am going to make everyone discuss their musical background as to, like, qualify what gives us the right to be having this conversation, mostly because I am the least qualified person here to be talking about all of this.
Erica holds a BFA.
Not in music, though. No, yeah. Jamaya, you're a professional musician. Speak on that.
I was just about to say, though, Erica, I feel like you are so talented that I'm such a fan of you and your voice and everything.
That doesn't mean I know chord progressions.
We're all, honestly, I've been in the music industry for 3 years, and there are still days that I forget about chord progressions as well. But anyway, I make music. I am a singer-songwriter based in Los Angeles. I've been writing music, pop music, since I was 16, but I actually did get my start in music by playing the violin in the Peninsula Youth Orchestra and the Bay Area. And my first composition experience was actually in orchestral composition and musical theater writing. So I've written musicals. I wrote a musical when I was an undergrad, the first year musical, and I did all of the orchestrations, all the composing. And that's where I really like got deep into my love of analyzing scores and soundtracks and everything. And from there, I transitioned to pop music. So I would say those are the two areas that I love the most. I also grew up singing jazz and playing the jazz fiddle, and also Indian classical music. And shockingly, I feel like there's going to be a lot of connection between that and the score, because some of these score elements, I think, bring in some of this specifically South Asian inspiration. And so, yeah, I am thrilled to be here. And also specifically with Percy Jackson, I write a lot of my music inspired by Greek mythology. My debut single, Achilles' Heel, which kind of jump-started this whole music thing for me, is all inspired by Greek mythology. And it's just something that I really love to bring into my music. And my last little tidbit of information is, last year, the like highlight of my career so far has been being invited to speak about the usage of Greek mythology in my popular music, pop music. I was invited by the Harvard Classics Department to come address some students last year and talk about that. And
woo-hoo!
That was a blast. And I talked at length about Percy Jackson in that guest lecture. So here we are.
You and Rick Riordan are both guest lecturers at Harvard to discuss Greek mythology. Look at that.
It's literally so full circle, because Becky Riordan retweeted a demo that I had posted of Achilles' Heel when I first posted it on social media. And she found out that I went to Harvard and was like, oh my gosh, you know, do you know this professor who hosted Rick Riordan? And I was like, yeah, he was my professor in college. And then 2 years later, I got invited by that professor to talk on the same stage, which is,
yeah,
everything is a circle. Is
100%
culmination of that. Anyway.
Also, because like you have had like, you know, I mean, there is no traditional path into music, but like, I think you've had a really cool path. Like, do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about like, did you study music in college? And like, no, you were able to transition. So like, basically, if you go to school and you study biology, kids, like, it's okay. You can still follow your dreams.
You can still do something good and cool with your life. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, thank you for saying that. And it's so interesting to talk about because when I went to college, I never thought in a million years I could ever do music professionally. I, you know, written songs my entire life and been practicing music, but I just didn't really think that there was a world where anyone would care about what I had to say or that I could break free from some of these culturally given ideas of what success looks like. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I was just terrified of disappointing my family, my community, and taking this beautiful gift of education that I'd received and a Harvard education and then not using it. In Harvard, mm-hmm. At Harvard, I was a debate kid. I competed on the mock trial team that took almost all my time. And in fact, I was so nervous about people even knowing that I wrote songs that I would do it in private at like 1 a.m. in my dorm's music practice room. I would sneak
in.
After
Demi Lovato camp rock.
It literally is. It's so dramatic the way that I say it. It does sound like a Disney movie. Speaking of Disney. But I do love kind of talking about that path and journey because I feel like we're living in a day and age where social media has opened up the idea of what an artist looks like, what a musician can look like. And mm-hmm. I get messages from, you know, people saying, I feel so stuck where I am in my life. I'm doing something that I'm not passionate about. And your story has inspired me to, you know, be an artist or pursue this passion. And literally nothing in my life makes me happier because, you know, it took me so long to realize that I could do music, that I was quote unquote good enough, battling imposter syndrome and mm-hmm, to get on mm-hmm. the other side of it. It took me so long to do that. And I just hope that people listening, you know, don't take as long as I did to realize that their dreams are possible. And, you know, you two are also so successful and, you know, it's just in artistic and creative endeavors and in podcasting
eye rolls,
and
eye
music.
We're rolling our eyes.
And it's just like, you know, you're showing that it's possible that people can achieve these big dreams. So that's my little soapbox monologue about music. And yeah, I hope everyone who has a dream for music is able to pursue it at some point in their life.
Yeah. Okay. So you are a violinist. Carter is also a violinist. And Carter, you're going to say some things about your music background and then I'm going to have to tack on and add things because you're not going to like, you're not going to describe it adequately, but go ahead and tell us about your background in music.
I think that I have a musical background that a lot of people will resonate with in the sense that I like played in an orchestra and some string quartets as a high schooler. I have some light piano background that was mostly focused around like jazz and music theory dense things. Like it was less about like going over Chopin etudes in lessons and more talking about like modes and looking at transcripts of specific improvised famous jazz piano solos and trying to like pick out things that we thought were cool to like riff on and you know, improvise based on.
You want to shout out your piano teacher?
My piano teacher was Ryoko Oka. She was very delightful and very nice about being able to pivot when we both realized at a certain point that I was you know, not going to be necessarily technically excellent as someone, you know, moving fingers across keys in specific classical and moving ways. Yeah. I think that's basically it.
Yeah, this is the part where I tack on and I say Carter is like my favorite musician on the planet. And growing up, I was just so in love with all of my friends and how talented they were because like all of our friends played in the orchestra growing up, except for me and our one other friend who did theater. Everybody was like an incredible string player and Carter played violin and viola in the orchestra and also in quartet like after school and also, you know, like was first chair violin our freshman year of high school and like the most advanced orchestra and it was such a big deal. And then our senior year, Carter was like one of like three or four musicians out of our senior class picked as like literally the best musicians in the class to play in like the best concert at the end of the year. And it was the most incredible experience of my life. And I recorded the entire thing on my iPhone and it's still on my iPhone. And I listen to it sometimes on my voice recordings. And Carter's a genius in a lot of ways, which I'm sure most people listening to this podcast have already learned. But the way you don't really get to hear Carter's genius all the time is they're genius in music. And so I'm excited to talk today. And also...
The one thing that we forgot to mention is that Eric and I were in a band together.
That's what I was gonna
in
say.
High school.
That's what I was gonna say. We were in a band in high school with our friends JD Guile and Alex Yam, and our band was called Alex and the Yams. And we did covers of Sarah Bareilles songs.
Which Sarah Bareilles songs? This is so important.
Some of our hits included covering Many the Miles.
I think Many the Miles is our most popular Sarah Bareilles cover. Did a bunch of Regina Spektor.
I would also say Little Black Dress was also a hit.
Yeah.
And then the highlight of this cover band was we would do Panic at the Disco songs with only a keyboard and a violin.
Or a cello. We would rotate sometimes. Sometimes there would be somebody like whacking, you know, like a hollow piece of wood so that we would have like floor to the floor percussion.
Yeah. If whatever you're imagining, imagine worse. And that's how bad it was.
Okay. We definitely had a lot of fun. We did specifically get asked by some teachers to be like, oh, hey, we're having like a little assembly at the end of the year and we need some like students who we know are going to give some good, clean, Christian singer-songwriter ballads for the class. So you want to do it? And we did. We said yes every time. And so people found out about who Regina Spektor was because we forced them to. Yeah. That was really fun.
That is incredible. I'm literally so honored to be like in the presence of Alex and the Yam. That's a cool band name, by the way. What the heck? And you had impeccable taste.
We had impeccable taste. That I will give us. Our taste was impeccable. And also, we did perform at the Hard Rock one time for only our parents. I don't remember how that happened, but that was fun.
Two or three assorted tourists, perhaps, who wandered in by accident.
At the Hard Rock Cafe in Waikiki over Christmas in, like, 2016. We always talk about reviving Alex and the Yams. Perhaps one day.
Perhaps one day, yeah.
I want, personally, to see this happen very much.
That to explain that Carter is an incredible musician and I technically have a degree that is technically associated with music, which means I technically completed college level music theory classes.
Yes, you did.
Technically. And that's my background in music. So let's go ahead.
Erica!
Hi, please.
Erica, you can find several recordings that Erica's participated in on Spotify, I believe, if you just search her name. So you can use that as a minimum way of understanding Erica's musical pedigree.
Okay, I'm a singer. I wouldn't call myself a musician. I've always been insecure about that, specifically because of how incredible our friends were growing up as like being musicians. Like, I always was insecure. Because I wasn't in orchestra, you know, I was in choir. And that's embarrassing, you know? That's a lack of true knowledge of how music works.
Singing is very important. Well, you don't just sing. Like, you definitely have, like, a stronger understanding of chording instruments and progression.
I go on Ultimate Guitar and sing myself to sleep with my little Lizzie McAlpine music like everyone else.
But see, yes! The thing is, like, most yeah. people who are in the symphony, like, probably genuinely would not... They would be, like, very confused by, like... a guitar tab, which is not to say that many people are not, you know, like many people also understand guitar, but you know what I'm saying? Like all forms of thinking about music and making your way into music are equally valid. And
yeah.
frankly, it's 2024. And if you know more about Beethoven than you do about guitar tabs, then I would reevaluate. I think that's like perhaps an opportunity for you, hypothetical person in this scenario, to also learn about guitar tabs. Because they're useful. Yeah. Okay.
I would say it's not, you know, knowing orchestral music is not orchestral to an understanding of music is how I would add to that. In not of any meaningful way, but just a punny way. I'm so sorry. That's it.
You literally need your own podcast because the pun contributions are just, they're great. And now we have to talk about someone who really knows a lot about music, and that's Bear McCreary, who scored this TV show. Now that's it. The background is over. We're 15 minutes into this episode, and we're going to start content. this man is incredibly prolific. And I'm just going to like list a couple things that are probably the things that our listeners would be most familiar with. This man literally nominated for Grammys. He's won Emmys. He scored Foundation, the show on Apple TV.
With Lee Pace.
Foundation starring Lee Pace on Apple TV. Black Sails, John and Dan's other show. The Walking Dead, starring Jason Momoa on Apple TV. Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., the Snowpiercer TV show. Godzilla, King of Monsters, the movie. The Halo TV show. And the video games Call of Duty Vanguard. And of course, God of War and God of War Ragnarok, which he was nominated for a Grammy for. Also, we discovered his father is a professor at the University of Hawaii. That's cool. That's where we're from.
UH Oceanography. Very prestigious. Yeah.
I stalked his Wikipedia page. That's how I learned that. He's also from Washington State, and he's a classically trained pianist. He went to the USC Thornton School of Music, which is where, like, everyone who's anyone in cinema composing went to. And his mentor was a man named Elmer Bernstein, who is extremely prolific and composed projects, like, as diverse and wide-ranging from To Kill a Mockingbird to Ghostbusters. And also, according to Wikipedia, Alan Menken and Alan Silvestri are also among the other people who consider themselves to be a part of Elmer Bernstein's legacy. So basically, Bear McCreary is simply not messing around here. So we're going to talk a little bit about our previous dreams for the soundtrack of Percy Jackson and also what our favorite soundtracks are. Jamiah, do you want to start us off?
Absolutely. I will also add one last note. For Bear plays the accordion, and I thought it was very important to start my talking about the score with that piece of information, because I cannot wait for there to be accordion in the next season of Percy Jackson.
Oh, yeah.
Wow, so many opportunities.
Exactly. I would say my dream for the soundtrack, I think Percy Jackson is at its core an adventure. It is an epic adventure. Yes, the books are so full of humor. Yes, the characters are incredibly lovable. But I think what brings so many people to Percy Jackson is just this universal desire for adventure and stories about that. And when I was thinking about the soundtrack for the show, I was like, I really hope that they treat the music for the show like the music they would for like a huge feature film about, you know, a group of people, a group of adults going on an adventure. And they don't try to kind of play down to the audience and try to create something that's quote unquote for kids, because it's technically a children's TV show. I thought that the score really, really delivered in that sense. Like, it felt, it was sweeping. It had low moments. It had high moments. It was taking you on a journey. And a score that I think was in my brain when I was thinking about the Percy Jackson show was the Hercules soundtrack, which happens to be my favorite soundtrack ever. And I think what I love about the Hercules soundtrack is obviously Alan Menken does such a good job with the score parts of it. There's a lot of woodwind instruments. There are fun moments that feel light, but also underscored by these heavier, kind of darker tones. What I love about what the soundtrack does is it incorporates some of these big pop melodies into the orchestral part of the soundtrack. And that's obviously what Disney does really well, is it, you know, intersperses very advanced orchestral technical parts of a score with chanting, you know, singable melodies that we all know and love. That's like the crux of a Disney song. So Go the Distance happens to be probably my favorite Disney song of all time. And we hear that theme recur throughout the score in different contexts. Sometimes it's light, sometimes it's darker. And I think what that accomplishes is it's accessible to a listener who, you know, is seeing the score play out on the, you know, oh my gosh, that's Go the Distance. We heard that in this part of the movie, because I think sometimes listeners aren't able to grasp onto more, the more complex melodies that are in the score as themes. So that was one thing that I was thinking about when I was thinking about the Percy Jackson soundtrack, is like, okay, are these themes going to be accessible? Are there something, you know, when you leave the theater or when you stop watching the show, you can hum it back to yourself. Is it catchy? So yeah, that was my dream journal for the soundtrack.
Hercules is such a great reference point.
It's also Greek mythology inspired, very differently so, but that was unintentional.
Carter?
Yeah, I would say that among my favorite soundtracks, I really like the scores of Shinkai Makoto's animated movies. These are the, like, specifically from the 2016 on, like, Your Name and Forward, Radwimps.
We have a whole Patreon episode on all of his movies you can listen to.
Yes,
Patreon.com/seaweedbrain.
Yeah, that was a really fun episode that we did. Recently, I think the soundtrack that I've been thinking about the most as I think about what a good soundtrack specifically for like a new project being made right now might look like is the work that was done on the Spider-Verse movies. Like, I think that those soundtracks are so cool, where like I think both of these like incorporate a lot of classical ideas about what makes a good symphonic score. Like, they have such a huge dynamic range. There's such a good variety of sounds and textures that allow you this like humongous emotional palette to play with as a composer, but also gives you the opportunity to create something that feels really like unique and original for the listener. At the same time, I should say that like if I were to pick though my like number one of all time favorite piece of soundtracking, it would probably be for the West Side Story film. Not just the musical numbers, which are important, but specifically like the instrumental orchestral pieces of that, I think are like the best music that has been written for audiovisual media. Like the mambos and the quartet backing tracks, the quintet, like when they were like leading up to the act one finale, mm-hmm. the like different ways that the different, like all the different themes weaving in and out, is very masterful. All of which is to say that like, I think what is most important in a soundtrack is range, expressiveness, specificity. But also, I was really not sure what to expect as far as like what kind of instrumentation they're going to go with. Like, I didn't know if it was going to be fully orchestral, if they were going to do something stripped out, if we were going to get like a Broadway orchestra of a classic rock band set and a string quartet and like two or three reed players. Who could say? I am pleased with how it turned out, though. We got the range, certainly, with this soundtrack. Erica, what were you thinking before hearing the soundtrack?
I think it's so unfair that you said West Side Story, because that's now, that opens up such a can of worms into like what our favorite scores of all time are. So I'm just going to ignore anything that is like a movie musical. There are receipts of this on our podcast. My dream for the soundtrack for season one was like pop, punk, pop, rock, all Fall Out Boy, and like just a lot of pulling in of previously existing pop songs and that sort of being the sound. But I recognize that that very much is influenced by what Percy's sound is. And I love that we got to talk to Joe Trace recently, because he talked about how Robert Kiki, in writing the Lightning Thief musical, did such a great job of using a different musical style for every character. So that is Percy's musical language, but it isn't the musical language of the entire world. And I can understand that. And I can concede that the John Williams inspired true orchestral music was definitely right for season one, even though I still wanted to hear Fall Out Boy like at least one time. That's okay. There's time, you know, in the future. And I want to also say Lilo and Stitch, because I think the soundtrack for Lilo and Stitch does what like my dream soundtrack does, which is has this gorgeous Alan Silvestri orchestral scoring that is so adventurous and so emotional and like very fantastical and magical, because there are aliens.
Yes.
But then also it is like 90% Elvis Presley music.
Yes.
And then like covers of Elvis Presley music by like modern singers. And so you've got like the traditional, the contemporary, the orchestral, and it's blending into this like cohesive, very quirky musical world that like really sets you in. Hawaii.
World building.
Like, that 100%. Is what Hawaii sounds like. And that's what I would like to see more of. Just some building in of some more original and pop music. Yeah.
Yes.
Going forward.
I agree completely. And I think that that note about personality, using music to build the world, but also showcase the personality of the movie or the series, is so important. And I think all of the soundtracks that we just named that we love do that to some extent, and kind of bringing together a diversity of kinds of music. Like you said, pop music, Hercules, it starts with a gospel number, but it makes sense. It brings you, it sucks you into the world in such an intriguing way. So yeah, I'm on board with that too. I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I should say here, we're also going to sort of use Bear McCreary's blog post from a couple weeks ago as like a guide to discussing the music here. And so I'm going to start with a quote that he wrote about like what they were discussing they wanted in the music. Mm. "The music of John Williams, Jerry Goldsmith, James Horner, Basil Poldoris, and other orchestral masters of film music came up in our preliminary discussions. We agreed there is something inherently timeless about fantasy scores such as Star Wars, Harry Potter, Poltergeist, Willow, or Conan the Barbarian, a quality we hoped our music could help bring to Percy Jackson. We wanted to build the score on a foundation of strong character themes stated in a classic orchestral sound, However, my ensemble at SNS and I also hoped the score would feel contemporary and not like a mere impersonation of an older classic era. We wanted to integrate modern music production techniques. While I began sketching themes, we also looked for exciting soloists, percussionists, voices, and synthesizers that could help us ground the symphonic score in a contemporary language.
Given that this was the target that they set for themselves, 100%, everything makes sense. I'm sure many people listening know who John Williams is. The other name that really jumped out to me in the list of influences that they listed was James Horner, who is famous, to me, most famous for the Titanic soundtrack, but also worked on such films as Avatar, Braveheart, etc. He has like a pretty specific palette, but like I think, like based on the age of our listeners, I don't know how familiar people frankly will be with the Titanic soundtrack, but if we're talking specifically about nautical music, they really set the bar high and establish a lot of the like staples that we think about when it comes to what makes things sound like the ocean. Like there's these brilliant passages in James Horner's work that like have like basically like five or six consecutive measures that are all in a different meter so that you can like feel the ship like going out
That's
into the open
so
ocean.
Cool.
It's all of those types of things where I definitely see like in specifically like, you know, Sea of Monsters, we're going to be in the ocean a lot. This time already, there are like specific pieces of soundtracking for the ocean, for Poseidon, that are like also like built into and later on Percy's themes. And I think that reference really, really spoke to me. We hear the ocean, we hear the moving triplicated rhythms in the orchestra underneath the themes and certain iterations and yeah.
Yeah. The fact that Bear worked on Black Sails also especially excites me for season
yes.
two.
Yes.
Nautical music.
The ocean.
I want to hear some restrained. Heavy metal sea shanties.
They're
100%.
Especially when Clarice comes riding in on whatever contraption that they're going to give her to ride in on.
And we should not be afraid to do, like, we're going to get into the individual character themes that we have so far in a bit. Percy's theme, I will say, if you redo that instrumentation with like a solo electric guitar lead, it works perfectly. That
yes!
would be a
electric
seamless
guitar.
Give me
yes!
electric guitar. Give us the electric guitar.
Something that really struck me about all of the references is that so many of those references are films and not TV series. And I think that makes me think about some of the unique challenges that are presented with scoring a series. In a movie, there is rising action, there's a climax, and then there's falling action, and there's just one course that is set in the film. It's like building, 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 developing, huge moments, and then it falls. In a TV series, you have that for the duration and the development of the series, right? Like the point A being episode one, point B being the last episode. But you also have all these mini moments of build and rising action and climax and falling action episode to episode, because that's how obviously these shows are structured, is like there is a mini boss in every episode that kind of culminates in the big boss. And when you get into the Percy Jackson universe, you know, season one could be classified as a smaller boss, as like the final boss of season five. Mm-hmm. And so I think that does present Sparks and Shadows and Bear McCreary with this unique question of like, okay, to what extent do we pull back a little bit earlier in the series or in episode to episode while still creating a fulfilling, you know, auditory experience for the person who's watching the show? And something that really struck me to this effect is Bear talking in the blog post about the fact that he didn't, with Annabeth's theme, ever have, you know, ever showcase it in its full orchestral glory. He's literally saving that for a future season. And that just goes to the amount of foresight and planning that this team has to go through in terms of like, okay, we have these themes, we have this batch of music. Like, how do we, you know, execute this in the way that is most effective in telling the story while not being short-sighted and like thinking about the fact that there are seasons to come? I just thought that was really interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I got emotional all over again reading the blog post, as I did when I heard about the famous Jules O'Loughlin lens flare. Because that level of like extreme detailed thought of the entire world, it's just, it makes sense why Bear frequently collaborates with Dan Schatz and John Steinberg, because that they just share that level of like extreme big brain specificity. Like, we are going to go as in depth into this as possible. And again, that like restraint, I think, is so important, because Carter and I talk about like how the lack of stability in streaming and the lack of like renewal for multiple seasons will like cause the content to suffer. Because if you were like trying to do everything right now because you don't know if you're going to season two or a season three, then sometimes the work will suffer because you're trying to do
or if you're trying to like back. Cash in on things to guarantee the next season. Yeah. Whereas in another ecosystem, you would have waited and saved them for the most optimal time, conditional on having 5 years to drop the moment.
But it's so great that like, even though that isn't guaranteed to them, that they're able to say like, no, like I'm going to restrain and like not pull all the punches yet because it's not, the story isn't ready for that.
Yeah.
Although it's not too late for us to right now just renew for an additional three seasons, four seasons.
Disney Plus, you should just right now get online and say, hey, guess what? We're going to renew it.
Let Netflix know who's the real boss is, you know, who's really setting the new pace for, you know, thrilling, fantastical television.
Literally, do not let Netflix show you up, Disney. That is embarrassing.
You can't let Netflix win. That's a little bit sad. But we should probably mention before we go further that a whole bunch of this blog post is written by not Bear, but Brian Clace. I hope I'm saying that name right. It is spelled C-L-A-E-Y-S, who, my understanding, is one of the people who is a part of Sparks and Shadows. A lot of the specifics that we're going to talk about with the individual character themes that are available for you to look at, specifically if you're listening to this being like, wow, wouldn't I would like to see some sheet music so I can understand what's going on. That sheet music is a part of this blog post, which is very detailed and written up specifically in Brian's section.
I'm going to read the description of Sparks and Shadows just so we can be like thorough about Sparks and Shadows is a multifaceted entertainment company founded by Emmy and BAFTA award-winning composer Bear McCreary. The company functions as a full-service music production studio, record label, publishing entity, and general headquarters from which all of McCreary's projects are developed, be they high-profile film scores, television scores, or video games, and other endeavors such as Broadway shows, graphic novels, and artist development. So there you go.
Graphic novels? This bear did a graphic novel? Like,
iconic.
Wow, I have so many questions about that. That sounds sick, though. Okay, work. Should we go theme by theme then at this point? Does that feel right?
I think it does. I also want to say I put out a sounding call on our Patreon for any questions from patrons, and Haley did talk about that thing that Bear mentioned about Annabeth's theme not being fully played out, and she asked, I'd love to hear you all speculate on what scenes we're going to get full character themes during. So we can think about that as we go through these themes here. I think that's a great question.
I love that. And all of them are going to have electric guitar. I'm manifesting that.
By season five, there's only electric guitars. That's it.
Yeah, you know how the Harry Potter movies gradually turned into being completely black? We're going to completely turn into just electric guitar. We're going to have an
50
orchestra
guitar.
Of like 50 electric guitars by the end. They'll have different like effect pedals or something. You know, we'll still, you know, textures. But
a tenor guitar, an alto guitar, a soprano guitar. It's a beautiful thing to behold, actually, when they all are in the same room together. We just need to get our act together, and then we can have it.
Hey, wow.
Oh, good.
Thank you.
Well, here's another quote from the article. This one is still Bear speaking. I wanted my end credit suite to offer clear statements of the three themes for the three primary protagonists, Percy, Annabeth, and Grover. My suite would conclude each episode with a rousing rendition of the Percy theme, moving into a lush and mature version of the Annabeth theme, and a playfully comedic spin on the Grover theme before returning to the heroic refrains of Percy's theme for the final fanfare. Percy Jackson gave me an opportunity to write the kind of cinematic theme suite I grew up on, and I was hopeful it would resonate with fans around the world. At the very least, I knew that I, for one, loved listening to it. Carter, you said it is wild how we got a theme overture for a TV show.
It's basically an overture, right? It's like giving you all the themes in a single musical number. Can you imagine a TV show deciding that they're going to commission a 5-minute piece of original orchestral music for credits? Who else is doing this? I'm struggling to think of any, like, certainly not network television. Mm. Most streaming services auto skip through all of this, right? Like, I don't know. I guess it was work that they would want to do anyway, but.
Yeah.
But it's great
to
have.
That music, that overture that ends up in the credits, calling it an overture in quotation marks, also works so well with the design of the credits themselves, which basically travel through the journey of the first book.
Wow, yes.
With the, you know, the images of the Chimera and the of Medusa and Waterland and everything.
Yes.
Yeah. And I also, within the themes, there's so many dynamics at play. Like Perseus's, first of all, I love that it's called Perseus. Small choices and like how they're naming some of these songs are just, I love it. But Percy's theme, it's I would say the most kind of stable of all the themes and just like the actual writing of it. But like mm-hmm. Annabeth's theme, oh my gosh, the amount of like chord changes that I did, that was mm-hmm. something that really stood out to me. And I know we'll go kind of theme by theme, but you know, comparing the sheet music of Annabeth's theme versus Grover's theme versus Percy's theme, it's very evident that there's a lot more kind of harmonic stuff going on in Annabeth's theme. Like there are suspended chords, there are inverted voicing. So the chords are literally like changing as the one chord is being voiced in a different way, you know, later in the theme. So there's a lot of like dynamism. And that's really interesting in the end credits as well, because you're right. It's like literally taking us through the journey from the high points to the low points and like everything that's encompassed in that within these themes. And I just love the amount of attention that was given within each theme to creating a soundscape that like builds and falls and rises and falls within each theme. So, you know, we're getting mini journeys next to each other to create this like big journey.
Yeah. Oh my God. I'm like overwhelmed. Okay. To talk a bit about Percy. This is now Brian speaking in the blog post. Quote, "We realized we needed a theme with the kind of duality that Percy himself represents. He is a powerful demigod as well as a caring, empathetic human being," end quote. That made my heart melt when I read that, because that's what we're always talking about, is like the duality of Percy and also the duality of the world of Percy Jackson, from the fantastical high stakes mm-hmm. to the like silly, quirky, goofy. What do you think about the fact that they chose a French horn for the melody?
Well, for now.
Right, until they switch to the electric guitar. And that's on puberty. That's on growth, right? You start a French horn and you end up an electric guitar.
I think it makes a lot of sense. And one of the things that I wrote down in my notes the first time I listened through this soundtrack was like, it sounds very American. Mm. And to me, like, one of the hallmarks of that is like Percy's score in particular gives us a melody that is missing the the median for most of the chords. Like, it gives us like D A A D A. It doesn't give us the F sharp. Mm. And so like, because this melody is so like, it's, you know, they're like long notes, they are like the bookends of the chords. It creates this like open sound. The use of horns, I think, also creates this open sound. It sounds like it's giving Williams, it's giving like Aaron Copland to establish a sense of grandeur. I think a horn is the right instrument, but you also have to save room, as they do in this version, to be able to layer on the rest of the section. So like the first pass we get is the French horn, and then the second pass we get, we layer on trumpets, trombones, so that we can then have like a stacked like chord voicing way through the melody that I think is very impactful. As a violinist who has occasionally been peeved in the past about the times where like the horns get the melody and you're just, you know, there's like 40 of you sitting there providing lushness and texture, that can be a little bit annoying, but like honestly, a lot of the times lushness and texture are what is called for.
Yeah, that's like every other hero at Camp Half-Blood provides the lush and the texture, and then like Percy's just soloing off in a corner, like it's just kind of carrying it on his back. And I loved what you were saying, especially about the chord choices and how that word that you used is exactly the word that I wrote down when I was thinking about this theme, open. You know, the D chord is considered like a grand open, like that when you're trying to create like this grand open sound, you would use that chord. I thought that was a really fitting choice. And something that Bear said in a video about this theme really stuck out to me. He says that Percy's theme has a rhythmic motor to it, and that this actually was also super interesting. He said it could be played by any instrument, i.e. electric guitar, and kind of still yeah, I added the last part, but but it could still have this driving force to it, played by any instrument. And I think that that is so telling about how Percy's character comes through in the score, that he is adaptable. You know, he is the driving force of this trio. He's the one, he's not Harry, no offense to Harry Potter, but like Harry Potter, you know, in that trio, Hermione is the rhythmic motor of that, that trio. In this trio, Percy, you know, it's not that he's making all the decisions himself. He's assuming all the control, but he is, at the end of the day, the heart, the beating heart of this trio. He's moving them forward in his own way. And I think that that comes through a lot in the score. And I just loved some of those terms that Barry used and some of those concepts. Yeah.
Absolutely. Also, to comment on something else you wrote in our outline, Carter, I'm going to mention this other quote. Quote, throughout the season, Percy's heroic theme also evolved into an emotional variant specific to his relationship with his mother with a unique harmonic progression. In the seventh episode, when Poseidon is first revealed in a heartfelt flashback sequence, this alternative harmonic progression provides a deep longing and empathy. And yet, crucially, the melody is missing, underlining the scene's subtext. Two parents struggling helplessly to provide for their child. First of all, what? Not them removing the melody while, like, they're talking about their child who isn't there in the scene. That's nuts. But also, Carter, I feel like you mentioned, you want to talk about how the melody is, like, repurposed and, like...
Yeah, I mean, I think in the song Perseus, you can hear multiple versions of this. Like, the overture version, I think we're just going to have to call it that. In the overture, we only kind of get the grand version where, like, it is scored by the string specifically doing this dun-dun-dun, 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 like, mm-hmm. rhythm that's very, like, propulsive, grand, adventurous. Mm-hmm. Whereas we get another version in Perseus. I think they're like both juxtaposed against each other. One of them is like slower, plaintive, and we get these calm, like legato movements through like chords to accompany it, and slightly different chord progressions under the same melody that give us, as they mentioned, this like other sense of like reflectiveness and calm. It almost feels like a moment of, you know, like meditation and rediscovery to juxtapose against the moments of action, of assuredness, of, you know, like needing to put on a face and face a challenge as opposed to needing to pause and look within yourself and figure out what the right approach is to the challenge or what the challenge means for you. The way that Percy's score is written is very well suited to these types of adaptations. And I think they do a really good job doing those reharmonizations, doing the alternate instrumental arrangements, which gives me great confidence. Not to put too fine a point on it, that if and when we add additional instruments or additional ideas about like musical languages to Percy's musical vocabulary, I think they will fit in very seamlessly. And it'll sound great when we have all different, like, the electric guitar, I think, is very important, but there are lots of different, I think you can imagine lots of different scenarios that Percy might face where you would want to like totally like reinvent everything about this in terms of mood and emotional palette and like choice of instrumentation. Like you can imagine this being redone with like thick synth pads or something in a moment of like that feels particularly otherworldly. Like what is a good example? You might imagine that like when like Percy is say like taking on the Titan's curse, you would want to like totally like retool the entire instrumentation, but you would still probably want to have the theme there.
Percy and Annabeth are dancing in the beginning of the Titan's curse and then it's like Percy's theme with a little but it's like synthed out and it's like almost diegetic. It's like the DJ is playing that at Westover Hall.
I would love that.
Yeah.
Wow.
But that has to be the part where Percy and Annabeth's themes start to like smush together, you know?
Yes.
I really like what I want. So I don't even know if this is possible given what Annabeth's theme is starting to sound like, but for them to somehow be able to be layered on top of one another in a way that makes a lot of sense would blow my mind.
100%. Like the way that it's set up right now in the overture is such that like when you move from one to the other, it sounds like if you have experience with, oh my god, why am I blanking on this form name? Is it concerto form? That's not right. Sonata form? There's a name. Wow, this is very embarrassing. There's like a typical classical music structure that it goes, you know, like main theme, and then you develop it, and then you go into like some sort of like, you know, related minor and do some sort of complication of that. Basically, what I'm saying is that this overture sounds like a complete piece of music, and this is that when you go from Percy's through to Annabeth's theme, it sounds exactly like as related and has the same emotional relationship that you would expect in, say, a Haydn string quartet when you're moving from like the first 40 measures into the next like 80 measures in the middle before you then come back to that first theme in a different key with like a different instrument playing the primary melody. You know, like I they're already like linked together in a way that surely a counter melody or some other way of like even more closely juxtaposing and bringing these things together will work out, be gratifying.
I love that. I want the smush. Give me the smush.
Give me the smush. The Percibeth smush of themes, especially over synth, especially at the start of Titan's Curse.
Ugh. I thought what you said, especially about kind of almost weaving it in a diegetic fashion, like that's almost like a cool thing to look forward to in some of these other seasons. It's like, how can we bring in the way that music is used diegetically so far in the series, which is like characters are listening to it, it's playing in some place when they walk in, and like start melding that, the musical world that they actually live in, into the fictional musical world that's underscoring what's happening. Like, I wonder if there is a way that this can start to happen more. And I just thought that was a really good point.
And then it starts to get a little meta, which is great, given the like framing device of the voiceover at the beginning of the season. I'm going to make a terrible producer decision here, podcast producer decision, and say we're going to split this conversation into two episodes because we've already been talking for like 45 minutes. And I'm trying so hard to do weekly episodes because everybody has told me that that's like really important to maintain engagement. So we're going to keep recording here. But for our listeners, we're going to pause this and you're going to get the rest of this conversation about the rest of the themes and what we want to hear in season two next week. So that means we need a quick plug from Jay Maya for this week's episode.
Oh my gosh. Hi everyone. I am Jay Maya. I write music inspired by books and stories and mythology, and specifically a lot of Greek mythology. And my next song that I have coming out comes out on April 5th. With an accompanying music video starring my wonderful friend, Jorge Rivera-Herrens, who some of you might know from writing the epic musical. And this song and music video are part of a concept album that tells the story of female gladiators in a fictional dystopian world who unite and take down the king that pitted them against each other in the first place. And we did an awesome DIY music video to tell this story. And the song also tells this story, and it comes out, and I can't wait to hear what you guys think about it. That's it.
Jorge is also someone I know, and I recorded a musical with him, and you can listen to that too. I think it's on our Spotify, like recommended, whatever. It's called My Heart Says Go. So we're going to finish our conversation here, but for listeners, we'll catch you guys next time for the rest of this discussion.